Now, President Biden announced earlier this week that the CIA killed a top al-Qaeda leader in a drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri is seen as a leading planner of the September 11th attacks in 2001. Here's President Biden announcing that mission.
Now, justice has been delivered, and this terrorist leader is no more. People around the world no longer need to fear the vicious and determined killer. The United States continues to demonstrate our resolve and our capacity to defend the American people against those who seek to do us harm. You know, we make it clear again tonight that no matter how long it takes, no matter where you hide, if you are a threat to our people, the United States will find you and take you out.
We're talking now about the events in Kabul this week and the wider evolution of U.S. counterterrorism policy in the decades since September 11th. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the biggest risks to national security? What do you think the United States should do to combat international terrorism, domestic terrorism? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow and director of research in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, where he specializes in U.S. defense strategy, the use of military force, and American national security policy. He also serves as a member of the Defense Policy Board at the U.S. Department of Defense. O'Hanlon is a member of the External Advisory Board at the CIA from 2011 through 2012. His most recent book is The Art of War in an Age of Peace. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's zoom in on the events this week. This key figure in the planning of September 11th. Can you talk a little bit about Ayman al-Zawahiri and the significance of this drone strike?
Well, first on Zawahiri, he, you know, as you know, is Egyptian and grew up in many ways protesting against his own government, involved in the assassination of Sadat four decades ago, although not a central trigger puller in that operation necessarily. So this was all part of Egyptian Islamic Jihad, a group that later wound up effectively merging with al-Qaeda. Certainly Zawahiri's role merged, and he became, of course, Osama bin Laden's deputy. So this now dates back, you know, more than 25 years. And as you know, it's about 25, 26 years since al-Qaeda declared war against the United States, which was followed up by the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. Zawahiri apparently had a role in that as mastermind, as motivator, as organizer. And of course, the 9/11 attacks, he may not have been one of the people who had his hands on the whole thing, but he was seen as one part visionary, one part organizer of the broader al-Qaeda network, recruiter, logistics specialist. You know, he just at a big ideas level, he really was central to everything that the organization was about. And so I would certainly, you know, some terrorism experts put him in really the number one spot, even ahead of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or Osama bin Laden, for his role in the 9/11 attacks and the sort of unique and central purpose that he played in doing all the things needed to make that attack possible. But regardless of where you put him in the pantheon, he was up there and probably the world's top surviving terrorist who is at large. Not so much in terms of what he was doing to us now, because he was spending most of his time trying to stay alive, which in the end, of course, he did not do. But because he still represented a figurehead in the organization and sort of a symbol of defiance and resilience and survival against the great satanic superpower that we purportedly are in al-Qaeda heads, he was therefore still even today, I think, a motivational presence for the organization, and his very survival itself constituted a show of some defiance against us. So in that sense, you know, I'm relieved that he's out of the picture, even though he really wasn't that active in most attacks of recent times with al-Qaeda or any other organization.
Now, this, of course, happened in Afghanistan. We had this long-running troop presence in Afghanistan that came to an end, negotiated by former President Trump, implemented in the early days of the Biden administration. And some Biden security officials are saying, pointing to this as an example, we can target terrorist figures, terrorist organizers, even in a place like Afghanistan, even without a large troop presence there. What do you think of that argument?
Well, it's true in this case. Let's hope it'll be true in other cases. You know, I don't know that this is really a great opportunity to get too overconfident. I want to give the primary credit, as I think most of us would, to the U.S. intelligence community, as opposed to a political figure who made a decision. I think President Biden made the right decision, but, you know, it's the intelligence community that did the months and years of work to figure out where this guy was. And, you know, to the extent they can repeat that phenomenal performance in regard to other terrorist leaders before those leaders are able to launch attacks against us, then we could be okay. To the extent that that feels like a little bit of a risky strategy, then again, I'd be a little bit reluctant to claim too much credit. I do think it's true that on balance, when you get somebody at that level of seniority and visibility, they're going to have a harder and harder time in the future staying away from our ability to find them. You know, but I'm worried more about sort of the places, the environments where terrorists are bred, in a sense, where they're recruited, where they do their quiet meetings before anybody knows who they are, where we don't have eyes and ears on the ground. We don't have alliances with local security forces or intelligence forces. And I fear that in those kinds of situations, figuring out who the next generation of leaders are going to be and who's the most dangerous, that's pretty hard to do from a distance. And it's a reason why I opposed the pullout from Afghanistan myself. But yes, in this case, it did work. And let's hope it'll work in the future.
And part of the negotiations for that pullout involved a commitment from the Taliban to say, we're not going to harbor international terrorist figures, especially those that present a threat to the United States. Now here's this guy in Kabul, presumably, it sounds like, with the knowledge of the Taliban. It's been suggested that means they've kind of gone back on that part of the deal. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. I think that it may not be all of the Taliban. It may be so-called Haqqani network, but that's a big part of the Taliban and certainly a part that we have to reckon with. You know, this is part of why most of us were pretty wary of a deal with the Taliban. We didn't think they had really changed their stripes. And, you know, on the other hand, it's not like they were encouraging Zawahiri to go attack New York again. And so maybe the Taliban thought they were sort of repaying a favor to an old friend who was at this point 71 years old, pretty harmless, really just hunkering down on his balcony, hoping for some, you know, morning air and not really going to hurt anybody. And they thought they could avoid picking a fight with us by virtue of that relatively limited, you know, refuge they provided to a longstanding friend. I'm hoping that's the way they looked at it, as opposed to the first step towards resumption of some of what they had been doing in the 1990s when they, you know, were much more active in supporting bin Laden. The real tragedy here, however, is that the Afghan people are now going to probably be condemned to an even longer period where their government is ostracized by the international community, cut off from the funds that it would like to access to prop up the Afghan economy at a time when half of Afghanistan's population is assessed by the World Food Program as being on the brink of famine or even starvation. And I was hoping that we could actually begin to reach a little bit of a modus vivendi with the Taliban. That would require some negotiations, some monitoring, and just as a way to get more food and medicine and money into Afghanistan for the good of the people. And I'm afraid that any thinking along those lines is probably now going to be postponed further, as we've seen the Taliban in cahoots with this former Al-Qaeda mastermind.
Michael O'Hanlon is with us from the Brookings Institution. We're looking at U.S. counterterrorism policy around the world after the drone strike against a main Al-Qaeda figure from the September 11th attacks and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Widening our scope, Mike, 20 plus years now since the September 11th attack. Big picture, what do you see changing since then in terms of the international terrorist threat to the United States?
Yeah, well, I think the simplest way to summarize is that the big plots are harder for Al-Qaeda or ISIS to carry out. The prominent ringleaders and organizers and motivators and masterminds of those organizations are mostly dead, in some cases behind bars. But the organizations continue to have a very strong presence throughout much of the broader Islamic world, especially the Middle East, especially North Africa, and some parts of South Asia. And this is primarily a threat to the people who live in those regions, because again, it's harder for these individuals to get through our multiple layers of security. We're watching for them a lot more carefully. We're devoting a lot of our intelligence resources still to the terrorist threat, as I think we have to, just to make sure that they can't reach the West. And they're still dangerous, you know, and they're still, in many cases, anxious to do a lot of the same things that they successfully achieved in the 9/11 attacks and before and after. So it's still a big problem. We haven't managed to reduce the appeal of the ideology. It's an ideology of anger and resistance and sort of, I think, false purity in Islamic terms. I think they've twisted Islam way beyond anything that's a reasonable interpretation. But unfortunately, that interpretation does appeal in some parts of the world where there's so much political anger and violence and anti-Westernism and poverty and, you know, other kinds of conditions that give rise to extremist ideology. So the ideology is alive and well, but the most gifted planners and motivators and organizers are largely now taken off the battlefield, at least in terms of this generation. And let's hope that we can, together with regional partners, make some inroads against the overall problem and popularity of these kinds of movements before the next generation figures out clever ways to attack us again.
We're talking to Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow and Director of Research in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, looking at how U.S. counterterrorism policy has changed in the years since the September 11th, 2001 attacks. That following on this recent U.S. drone strike that killed a top al-Qaeda leader who had been part of the planning for the September 11th attacks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want the United States to engage with the world to prevent future attacks? Do you think we've been too quick to intervene in other countries, or too quick to use drone strikes, or not using them enough? What questions do you have for our guest about national security risks and responses in the U.S.? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Mike O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow and Director of Research in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, looking at the ways U.S. counterterrorism policy has shifted in recent years. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think it was the right move to pull troops out of Afghanistan? Could it have gone better? What should the U.S. priorities be when it comes to counterterrorism around the world and here at home? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Mike, of course, another big change after September 11th was this huge reorganization of national security and intelligence agencies into the Department of Homeland Security. Big picture. Was that done effectively? Are there changes maybe that need to be done now in 2022?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, just to be clear, also, the intelligence communities remain distinct. You know, the intelligence organizations are now organized under this Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And that's a new separate sort of headquarters agency. And CIA and DIA and other agencies are still separate and independent or part of the Department of Defense to the extent they have, you know, a traditional departmental home. But the Department of Homeland Security does have its own intelligence capabilities as well, but also, of course, Coast Guard, border security, and so forth. You know, I thought it was a questionable idea to create it at the time. It seemed like you were bringing together very disparate kinds of capabilities that didn't necessarily share a common culture or set of professional expertise or, you know, methods. And that building this organization would be ultimately a time-consuming venture that would distract from the actual work of securing the borders and finding the bad guys and, you know, running the Coast Guard and everything else that's done within that agency. At this point, I don't propose that we undo it. I still think it was a dubious, you know, idea. I would have, especially given the difficulty we've had with immigration reform and securing the border since then and the partisan politics that have become associated with that debate, I would rather have used the period right after 9/11 when we had some consensus on these problems to figure out a better strategy for the border and for immigration. And maybe we could have channeled our energy into solving that more specific problem rather than creating this giant, you know, behemoth of disparate capabilities that included, you know, more than a dozen pre-existing agencies, as I recall. But, you know, what's done is done. And I think there are a lot of good people at DHS and they've had some good leaders. And, you know, some of the individual capabilities like the Coast Guard are still essentially run separately and haven't really lost their excellence or their professionalism or their resource base. So on balance, I don't consider it a top tier issue. It was a questionable way to prioritize much of our response back in the day, you know, in 2004 or so when it was created. But at this point, there's probably no huge harm in having it under this form either. And I wouldn't propose that we yet again reinvent it.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us on the Lacouture Reservation. Robert, hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Robert?
Well, for my part, I know a lot of people ain't going to like to hear this, but I do not believe that America is any longer in the right. Any revenge that they were entitled to has long since been dispensed. For one, too many civilians have been killed through the course of this war, and none of them are the responsible parties on either side. Osama was a terrible guy, absolutely. He was just an old man giving orders, just like on the other side. Whatever reasons he had to be angry at this country are his own business. But a lot of the deaths, most of the deaths, I would say, in Afghanistan had been civilians. Any animosity or culture of hatred toward America at this point is America's own fault. If those people are angry, it is not directed at Al-Qaeda or any of the Taliban leaders. It's at the strangers who invaded their country over a guy they never met.
Robert, thanks for the call. Mike Roberts sees the U.S. moral image in Afghanistan hurt by the long-running U.S. military presence there.
Well, he makes a lot of interesting points, some of which I certainly agree with, some of which perhaps less so. Zawahiri, of course, was Egyptian, and he was not implicated directly in this question of what should happen to the future of Afghanistan, except that the previous and current government, the Taliban, had provided him and his Al-Qaeda associates sanctuary. So that's, of course, why we went in after 9/11. The whole war in Afghanistan and whether we should have left, I think it's going to be debated for a long time to come. My view is that it's true there were a lot of civilian casualties, and it's true that, in a sense, we helped the Afghan government fight the war longer than perhaps it could have without us. So, in a sense, we helped perpetuate the conflict. But it's also true that the Taliban don't know how to govern the country. And now, whatever, you know, solace there might be in having less killing, and that is very important, there, that's largely dominated or, you know, superseded by the huge number of people who are going to die of starvation and privation and disease because the country's not functioning. And so that's the downside to having pulled out and seeing the Taliban regain power. There's less shooting death, but there's a lot more death from just this now being a failed state. And I think we'll all be debating the future of that, you know, well into the future. I'm more interested in seeing, is there a way we can talk to the Taliban and say, if you'll reopen those girls' high schools, if you'll make sure that we have some monitors who can make sure you don't oppress or torture or kill your former opponents or minorities or the Hazara, you know, the Shia group inside of Afghanistan, we will allow you access to your funds and foreign trade to flow and so forth so that you can begin to rescue this economy and the Afghan people. That's where I want to go with the debate. I take your points, Robert, about, you know, this mission we've carried out for 20 years had a lot of downsides to it, was not as successful as it should have been, as many of us, including me, thought it could have been. It was still a much more carefully conducted military operation than, let's say, what we did in Vietnam or what the Soviets did in Afghanistan. And I think we really tried hard to protect civilians, but you're right, there were a lot of casualties and a lot of downsides to our operation there.
Thanks for that call. Kirk joins us now in Madison. Kirk, hello.
Hello. My call is also about the killing of the Al-Qaeda leader. And I ask, is there an ethical problem with assassinating someone in a foreign country?
Kirk, thanks for the call. Mike?
You know, I have to say on this one that I think there was a strategic necessity to show the Taliban that if they work with Al-Qaeda in the future, we will, in a very proportionate and specific way, take action, that we are not going to stand by and let them do again in 2022 what they did in the 1990s into the period before the 2000-2001 attacks. So the ethical question to me has to follow from that strategic analysis. Maybe that's a callous way for me to look at it, but we can't take the risk of another 9/11. And therefore the Taliban, some of them are the same people who ran the place back 25 years ago, or at least, you know, the follow-ons to that leadership generation. They have to know if you mess with Al-Qaeda or other groups that still have ideologies and ambitions to attack the West, we will take action. The Taliban should be grateful. The only guy we killed was Zawahiri. We were very, very careful about that. And I give a lot of credit, obviously, to the men and women of the intelligence community who figured out just where he was and figured out a way to target only him. And I think President Biden made the right decision. I do think it was ethical because it was a guy who's got the blood of several thousand Americans on his hands. And moreover, as I say, there was a strategic importance to showing that we won't be intimidated from taking this kind of action. Therefore, Taliban, take notice. Don't team up with Al-Qaeda again.
Kirk, thanks for that call. And Mike, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow and director of research and foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. He serves as a member of the Defense Policy Board at the U.S. Department of Defense. His most recent book is called The Art of War in an Age of Peace. He talked to us today about the evolution of U.S. counterterrorism policies in the last two decades. That's in the wake of the recent U.S. drone strike that killed a top Al-Qaeda leader in Afghanistan, in Kabul.